Hello, I'm Dr. Alan Gaboski, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Practicing Precision Medicine in Psoriatic Arthritis, Strategies and Digital Health Tools for Managing a Chronic Disease. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, a best-in-class accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. And I encourage you to visit the website for additional educational activities and resources, including digital hubs in various therapeutic areas with very valuable tools for you and your patients. Our goal of today's activity is to ultimately help you improve the lives of your patients with psoriatic arthritis. One last reminder, 2018 is the first full year for many of you participating in the MIPS program. Part of meeting your requirements under the Quality Payment Program is participating in improvement activities. Today's program has been designed to meet those requirements. Your active participation, answering polling questions, asking a question, completing the evaluation and post-test is the first step in the process. After today's program, actively work to incorporate the clinical improvements we discuss into your practice. And in 3 to 4 months, we will send you a survey to complete, which will fulfill the data collection requirements. CME Outfitters will then send you confirmation of your participation to submit to CMS. As I mentioned, I'm Dr. Alan Gaboski. I'm Professor of Medicine and Healthcare Policy and Research at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. I'm also an attending rheumatologist at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City, New York. I'm looking forward to our discussion today, which will focus on a personalized team approach to the care of patients with psoriatic arthritis. I'm excited about our program, and we're going to share some best practices for managing psoriatic arthritis and provide some tips that you can integrate into your practice. So let me introduce our faculty joining me today. First, let me welcome Dr. Joel M. Gelfand. Joel is Professor of Dermatology, Professor of Epidemiology, Vice Chair of Clinical Research, and Medical Director of the Dermatology Clinical Studies Unit, and Director of the Psoriasis and Phototherapy Treatment Center at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joel, welcome.
It's good to be here with you.
Thank you. Also, let me introduce Dr. Jennifer G. Kwan-Morley. Dr. Kwan-Morley is a rheumatologist at Premier Orthopedics here in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Alan.
So thank you both for joining me today, and let's get right into it. Let's begin with a brief introduction to psoriatic arthritis. Joel, take us through this.
Yeah, so in a very elegant paper recently came out by Phil Meese and colleagues, they looked at the challenges of diagnosing psoriatic arthritis. And our colleagues in the audience should know that this is a difficult disease to pick up and therefore requires additional thinking and screening activities. And a nicely done study. They looked at patients being seen by dermatologists educated in this disease, and more than 10% of the patients actually had active psoriatic arthritis that was not picked up in routine clinical practice when then seen by a rheumatologist. Typically, arthritis will occur on or after the onset of skin disease, not always, but most commonly. And so skin disease is a harbinger of things to come when it comes to the joints. The prevalence or likelihood of developing psoriatic arthritis increases with the severity of skin psoriasis, but the correlation between severity of psoriatic arthritis and severity of skin disease is actually pretty weak, and so it's hard to predict which of our patients will go on to have progressive psoriatic arthritis with joint damage, something we very much want to try to prevent. That being said, some markers like a CRP in the blood, if it's elevated or having multiple joints involved, give some prognostic implications for the likelihood of the patient to have progressive joint damage. And of course, with psoriatic arthritis, different from other arthropathies, inflammatory arthritides like rheumatoid arthritis, there's the added burden of skin disease, and therefore there's a significant psychosocial burden of having two hits, both to the joints and to the skin.
Now, psoriatic arthritis also has a strong genetic component, so Joel, tell us a little bit about the genetics of the disease and what we should keep in mind from that perspective as well.
Yeah, so remarkably, this is an important thing to know about because of all the complex inherited traits out there, say inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis is actually the most heritable of all of these complex immunologic disease traits. And the more we learn about the genetic features of psoriatic arthritis, the more we're able to have rational development of therapies, for example. So we know IL-23, for example, is a loci that is a susceptibility gene for developing this condition. And increasingly, therapies that target IL-23 are being developed for psoriatic arthritis. So it's good sort of bench-to-bedside type work allow us to improve the care of our patients.
So Joel talked about genes in psoriatic arthritis. Let me quickly review the pathogenetic pathways of psoriatic arthritis. Begin from the overriding concept that disease occurs in genetically susceptible individuals who encounter an environmental trigger or perhaps multiple triggers. And that will allow us to understand why it is that we have these different phenotypes with immunologic activities taking place in the skin, the bone marrow, the gut, and when it comes to psoriatic arthritis, not just the joints, but in structures around the joints, such as the enthesis. And we'll get into this a little bit more when we look at the specific cells and the pathways that are being used to block these as well. So let's move on to the screening of psoriatic arthritis in clinical practice. Jennifer, what should clinicians look for when screening for psoriatic arthritis?
So what we're really looking for is inflammatory arthritis or inflammatory conditions. So things that we would screen in terms of questions would be morning stiffness, are we having joint swelling, joint tenderness, joint pain that improves with activities, looking for dactylitis or the so-called sausage digits, enthesitis, inflammation at the tendons and the ligament insertions, inflammatory back pain. And when we're talking about that, we're really talking about significant back stiffness or pain that really can last an hour or more in the morning, as well as eye symptoms such as uveitis. So there are four clinical pictures here to demonstrate different things, including those starting on the left, nail pitting, as well as you could see a little bit of DIP swelling and inflammation. The second picture from the left includes dactylitis on the left second toe. The third picture from the left includes Achilles tendonitis and enthesitis, and you'll see that on the right ankle. And then the fourth picture shows psoriasis as well as arthritis, and really demonstrates how much pressure you need to put on the joint in order to see the kind of pain you might get. So you'll really have enough pressure to blanch the bottom third of your fingernail to really evaluate for psoriatic arthritis.
I think the clinical image on the left of the nail disease is important for clinicians to know about. Mm-hmm. That nail disease, some people think it's actually a form of enthesitis. And so patients who have psoriatic nail disease much more likely to go on to develop psoriatic arthritis, especially in the DIPs and PIPs. And interestingly, other anatomic locations also seem to predict higher frequencies of developing psoriatic arthritis. Scalp disease and intracluteal cleft fold disease predict future rates of PSA. And so examining the patient may give you more insights into their likelihood that their comorbid joint symptoms are likely inflammatory in nature.
Good points, but I'm particularly intrigued by the nail on the far right, which of course is yours for our audience to be aware of in case they use the image in future teaching activities. So let's get our audience involved. You'll see an audience response question on your screen, and the question is, what test is definitive for psoriatic arthritis? A, the C-reactive protein, because an elevated C-reactive protein confirms psoriatic arthritis. B, the X-ray alone is confirmatory. C, the rheumatoid factor is the most reliable. D, the CCP antibody is the most reliable. E, none of the above. Now, we'll see what our audience had to say in a minute, but Joel, what can you tell us about the various tests and how reliable they are when making a diagnosis?
Yeah, so I think we know what some of the clinical symptoms are for developing psoriatic arthritis, and the clinician is sort of challenged with how to make this diagnosis or screen for having an inflammatory joint disease in patients with skin disease psoriasis. And a variety of agents, or tests I should say, have been developed, really surveys or questionnaires that you can give to patients to try and screen to see if they have symptoms that are likely to be inflammatory joint disease or psoriatic arthritis. Unfortunately, this is a tough disease to diagnose, and that's why it takes a lot of expertise to get good at diagnosing psoriatic arthritis. And none of these screening tools work that well in clinical practice, or not routinely used. So typically in my clinical practice, what I'll do is I'll ask about joint pain, stiffness, and swelling. If it's present, I'll try and differentiate, is it more in the morning and better with activity, or is it more after a lot of prolonged use or at the end of the day? And then maybe I'll ask them a question about, well, do you have joint pain or swelling or stiffness that's significant enough that you want to do something about it? And all these type of questions give me a sense of, well, who needs to see a joint specialist?
So Jennifer, you're sitting quietly while you're listening to a dermatologist take a joint history. Anything you'd like to add as a rheumatologist?
Yes, I mean, screening tests that would be useful would be x-rays of the joints, maybe a C-reactive protein to see if there's any systemic inflammation that might be associated, a rheumatoid factor or CCP to perhaps exclude other arthritides such as rheumatoid arthritis. And it, of course, it's not a comprehensive list, but that would be a good place in terms of screening psoriatic arthritis.
I find these really helpful tips for my clinical practice, because a lot of times my patients are predominantly concerned about their skin. They don't want to see another doctor. They don't want to see another dermatologist. I mean, another rheumatologist, I should say. And so if they have signs that their disease may progress, that's going to push me harder to have them see a rheumatologist. So x-rays of the hands and the feet when they have symptoms there is where you may see joint erosions, for example. And then occasionally we pick up people who have rheumatoid arthritis. So some dermatologists may feel comfortable, I'm going to use a disease-modifying agent. They have skin disease and joint disease, but they have RA. We really want to make sure to see a rheumatologist. So the CCP, rheumatoid factor, very helpful in that circumstance.
So before we hear from the audience or the results of the first question, let's talk a little bit about the common comorbidities in patients with psoriatic arthritis. Joel, maybe you can kick off the discussion with a discussion about the cardiovascular disease risks.
Yeah, so this is an area that really has taken off in our understanding and knowledge in the last 10 to 15 years. Specifically, cardiometabolic outcomes are worse off in people with psoriatic disease. And what's interesting, if you think about psoriatic arthritis and psoriasis compared to, say, rheumatoid arthritis, which has some similar pathophysiologies and shares some treatments, but not all, you see diabetes is much more prevalent in the psoriatic disease population compared to the rheumatoid arthritis population. And this is accounting for other risk factors. So it really tells us that these are different diseases than RA, despite the fact they have some different similarities. And it's an important thing for us to educate patients about, because this is the most likely common cause for premature mortality. And many of these patients aren't aware of these associations, or maybe underscreened or undertreated for existing cardiovascular risk factors, high blood pressure, cholesterol, things of that nature.
So Jennifer, anything you'd like to add from the perspective of other comorbidities that we may see in our patients?
Yes, so like some of our other arthritides, there are extra-articular manifestations than just the arthritis. So ocular inflammation, Lambert and Wilson in the mid-1970s described that up to 30% of psoriatic arthritis patients can have eye findings, including iritis, episcleritis, uveitis, in addition, inflammatory bowel disease. So there was a study last year in inflammatory bowel disease, and it showed that the prevalence of IBD in psoriatic arthritis patients is four times the prevalence of the general population. And of course, just as Joel had alluded to before, you really can't underestimate the psychosocial burden. I mean, the skin disease is something that patients really feel strongly about, because not only do they have their arthritis that affects their daily living, they have something external that people can see that really does affect depression, suicidality, and other psychosocial burdens.
So the results are in from our first audience response question. Fairly interesting. We have 18% of the audience that said that the CRP is the way to make the diagnosis. 3% said the x-ray. 9% said the rheumatoid factor. 30% said the CCP. And 41% said none. Comments? Jen?
Can we just, going back to the slide, I think that the answer would be it is a clinical diagnosis. So you really have to look at all of the different features. It can't just be because of the C-reactive protein. The x-ray, if it shows distinctive features of psoriatic arthritis, is very helpful. But the rheumatoid factor and CCP is really more to exclude other diseases. So it really has to be a combination of multiple testing.
Joel, any surprises?
I think the 41% have it. Clearly, the right answer is none of the above. The CRP, I think, also is one to be aware of, that in psoriatic arthritis, it doesn't perform as well as you would hope. And so it doesn't correlate that well with disease activity. Patients can still be at risk for advancing disease despite having a normal CRP. If it's elevated and you're convinced they have psoriatic arthritis, it may be helpful in that circumstance. But if it's normal, you still have to take the disease pretty seriously.
Okay, we've set the background, and now let's focus on the specific learning objectives, beginning with learning objective one, namely to identify the molecular targets of currently available and emerging biologic treatments for the management of psoriatic arthritis. Let's begin by diving into the molecular and cellular pathways behind psoriatic arthritis, which is important to know, as knowledge of that will help us define where the targets are for our various treatments. You've heard me say that disease occurs in genetically susceptible individuals who encounter an environmental trigger or triggers. As a result, we have the interplay between both the innate immune system, which is really there to prevent us from ourselves, and we have the adaptive immune system, which is there to protect us from foreign infections with external organisms. And you can see on this slide that there is a well carefully calculated orchestra of interactions between multiple cells and mediators that they secrete in order to affect the production of additional mediators, ultimately resulting in the clinical phenotypes that we see and have been discussing as part of psoriatic arthritis. You can also appreciate that there are a number of red bars which represent potential targets whereby inhibiting the agents that are causing cell-cell interaction or distal cell interaction, we may be able to downregulate the clinical expression of the disease. So let's talk a bit about the drugs for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis and how we are targeting these molecules in clinical practice. Joel, walk us through the treatment of psoriasis.
Yeah, so I think the paradigm is changing rapidly, and I think it's important for clinicians to think about ways of providing this information to patients in ways they can understand and organize frameworks. So, of course, in dermatology, we have the advantage of being able to treat just the skin. We don't always have to use systemic medications. And so I'll talk to patients and say, well, we have topical approaches, we have ultraviolet light approaches, we have oral medications, we have injectable medications. And then based on what I know about their disease severity and the burden that's affecting the patient in terms of their health-related quality of life, that will help me shift and narrow the discussion. So patients who, say, have comorbid joint symptoms and extensive skin disease will be talking about using either oral medications or biologic injectable medications and helping the patient understand within those classes what we could do. For a pill, most commonly these days we use methotrexate or Premalest. In some circumstances, maybe cyclosporine or acitretin. And of course, in the biologics, we have three general classes, TNF-alpha strategy, a IL-17 strategy, and then the IL-23, or it used to be IL-12-23 strategy, but it used to ustekinumab or the emerging IL-23 inhibitors.
And extending that discussion to psoriatic arthritis, we, of course, make use of many of the same agents in many of the same categories. But in addition, we have some others. Under the oral treatments, we have JAK inhibitors. Under the conventional or small molecule synthetics, in addition to methotrexate, we have sulfasalazine and leflunomide. And under the biologics, in addition to the ones that Joel has described, we have a CD80/86 inhibitor. And so our therapeutic armamentarium for both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, as we'll explore in a few minutes, is increasing rapidly with multiple options available to us. So let's spend a little bit of time going through the specific agents in more detail, particularly those in each drug class and their indications. Let's start with the biologic agents. Joel, what are the treatments you often use as a dermatologist, having alluded to them in the last slide?
Yeah, so I think we, again, have the good fortune of having many good options for our patients these days. Within the TNF classes of drugs in a dermatology setting, these days most commonly using adalimumab or recently certolizumab has been approved for psoriasis. And part of the reason why those are preferred by dermatologists is they tend to be higher efficacy in the skin than, say, compared to etanercept. Golimumab is not approved for psoriasis currently, so it's not used heavily in a dermatology setting. And infliximab, although it has very good efficacy in the skin, many of our patients don't want to have infusions and therefore opt for subcutaneous type injections. Now, some of our newer therapies, the IL-12-23 inhibitors and the IL-23 inhibitors, have advantages like being dosed every 8 to 12 weeks, for example, as opposed to being dosed every 2 weeks to every month for some of our TNF inhibitors. Similarly, IL-17 inhibitors, also subcutaneous drugs, dosed approximately monthly, depending on which one we pick, have very high efficacy in the skin.
We can also talk about some of the other class of agents. We can talk specifically about the oral agents that are available to us. We have two small molecule oral treatments. We have a Premalast, a PDE4 inhibitor that has been approved for psoriasis and for psoriatic arthritis. And of course, we have tofacitinib, which is a JAK inhibitor, which has been approved for psoriatic arthritis. But we do know that not all drugs work in all patients. And today, our discussion really should focus about precision medicine. So let's see how our audience does in translating some of what we've been discussing about the data into clinical practice. So there's a case question on your screen. A 23-year-old female referred to you by the dermatologist for psoriasis and evaluation of psoriatic arthritis. She has psoriasis since age 16, which has been managed with topical steroids. And for the last year, she's had joint pain. She's been on methotrexate, 20 milligrams per week for the past year for her joint pain. Upon examination, you note psoriasis covering 5% of her body surface area, sores in her mouth, and two swollen and tender joints on each hand. X-rays show no joint erosion. Which of the following would be a reasonable next step in managing her? A, increase the methotrexate to 25 milligrams a week. B, add apremilast. C, switch her from methotrexate to a TNF inhibitor. D, I would not change her management plan until more tests are performed. E, I don't know. And while we're waiting for the audience response to come in, let me ask each of you, Jen, let me start with you, how you individualize your treatment plan.
It really is an individualized treatment plan. That's exactly right. I mean, it depends a lot on the patient. It depends on their lifestyle, what they're willing to do, what the current recommendations are in terms of guidelines. We have patients who will only take an oral medication, who don't want to do an injectable, who don't have the time to do an infusion. All of those things do make a difference. Compliance is extremely important. The studies, the outcomes in terms of the study are only as good as if the patient actually takes the medication as prescribed. So all of those would be reasonable. All of those are choices to be made when you're choosing therapies for the patients.
Interesting. Joel, your perspectives?
Yeah, so I think from a dermatologist's perspective, we're also trying to understand the burden the disease is having on a health-related quality of life. Mm-hmm. Trying to understand from the patient, are they having emotional impairment from their psoriasis in terms of what clothes they're able to wear, what activities they can participate in, their social relationships, their work relationships, what kind of physical symptoms they're having from their psoriasis and how severe it is. Those things will help guide us in addition to our clinical examination about how aggressive to be in trying to control this disease. I think comorbidities are very important as well. There's a lot of overlapping health issues in people with psoriasis. Someone who has underlying bowel disease, for example, some of the TNF inhibitors could be effective for both skin, joints, and Crohn's disease, for example. So those are things that I think help us really narrow down the patient's individual health picture, their clinical presentation, and the burden of their disease to choose the right therapy for them.
So do you think that our patients are as concerned with this concept of precision medicine as we are?
I think from a patient's perspective, they want a therapy that's going to work for them. They want the right medication at the right time that's going to improve their quality of life, improve their joint disease, prevent joint damage, clear their skin with a low risk of side effects. That's still safety is still very important to our patients.
Okay, the people have spoken. In terms of the answers that they've given, 14% with increased methotrexate, 9% with added apremilast, 40% would switch her from methotrexate to a TNF inhibitor, 9% would not change the management plan pending additional tests, and 27% don't know. Jen, what do you think?
I think this is where the art of medicine comes in. So if you follow guidelines and you follow the ACR guidelines, for example, you might switch her from methotrexate to a TNF inhibitor. I would avoid increasing the methotrexate only because she's already having sores in her mouth, and increasing the methotrexate is only potentially going to make that worse. But there could be an argument made for adding apremilast in a young female who has minimal joint disease. That would not be an incorrect answer as well.
Joel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the pearls that our audience should know about is that young women tend to be particularly affected by the skin disease in terms of health-related quality of life impairments based on a variety of studies that have been done. So this young person who has 5% of her body surface area involved, she may not qualify for a clinical trial of a psoriasis agent, but she's likely to have fairly significant impairment and someone whose skin I'm going to try and clear along the way. Of course, she's of childbearing potential as well. Methotrexate is a category X type medication, cause birth effects. And so one might make a strong argument and say, well, she really hasn't done well enough. Why don't we move her off methotrexate onto other agents?
great discussion. And we've talked a little bit about the currently approved agents, and we've talked about some clinical tips on integrating precision medicine into your practice. But as you heard Jen remark, caring for patients is more than just medicine and involves more than one type of provider. We really do have to think about the overall and comprehensive management of the patient with psoriatic arthritis. So, Joel, who should be the members of the management team for patients with psoriatic arthritis, and what role do you see them playing?
Yeah, so I think invariably this care team has to include a rheumatologist and a dermatologist, because these are chronic diseases, they're common diseases, and one physician is unlikely to be able to manage all aspects of it for the entirety of their practice. So knowing someone in your community, if you're a dermatologist, identifying a rheumatologist interested in this disease state, and on the other hand, same thing, if you're a rheumatologist, finding dermatologists who are interested in this disease state. Because not all rheumatologists, not all dermatologists are expert or up to date on the advances in managing this disease. I think collaborating closely with primary care or potentially cardiovascular medicine or prevention clinics, because these patients tend to be loaded with cardiovascular risk factors. They have a lot of hypertension, a lot of insulin resistance, a lot of dyslipidemias, and making sure they're plugged in and have good preventative health care is important as well.
So, Jen, Joel's given us a nice segue into what thoughts you may have about how you enlist other members of the healthcare team who may not be specifically mentioned in the Venn diagram. Your thoughts?
Yes. So I think psoriatic arthritis, even more so than a lot of our other rheumatic diseases, really truly have aspects of this Venn diagram that are important just because, again, they have an external manifestation of their disease. So primary care doctors, psychiatrists, really helping to manage their depression, anxiety, physical functions. Of course, in terms of the rheumatologist is important, but getting them to a physical therapist or an occupational therapist, to get them moving again and get their joints moving is extremely important.
So, Joel, I've previously put you on the spot by asking what kinds of things dermatologists should be looking for in the joints. Let me flip that around and ask you what kinds of things rheumatologists should be looking for in the skin of our patients, particularly with psoriatic arthritis, how we should monitor them for the presence of skin disease if they don't have it initially when they present, and maybe just when we should be referring patients to the dermatologist.
Yeah, so this is a great question and a great opportunity to sort of talk about this collaborative relationship dermatologists and rheumatologists have. Certainly, the first step is looking head to toe. Psoriasis can affect anywhere in the body, from the scalp to the intergluteal cleft fold, to the plantar surfaces of the feet. And so doing a full skin exam is pretty important in these patients. You'll have a better insight into areas of what we call hidden psoriasis. So someone comes in with inflammatory joint pain, you don't know if it's RA or rheumatoid arthritis. Well, if you check behind the ears and try and find psoriasis or an intergluteal cleft, you may be able to make a diagnosis clinically by picking up the cutaneous disease. Quantifying the body surface area involved, a simple technique is use what's called the palm method, where you think about the palm of the patient's hand being about 1% of their body. And so if they have enough psoriasis to cover, say, 10 palms of their body, it's about 10% of the body surface area. By having that quantification, allow you to track over time how the patient's doing. You can show patients the progress. You know, when we first started on this medication, your body surface area was 20%, and today you're down to 1%. That's often a really helpful perspective for the patients. Also helpful for our insurers as well when they're reviewing charts and justifying the use of some of our more expensive therapies. I think skin cancer screening is really important as well. It's important for my colleagues to know that that psoriasis patches can resemble basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas, so that isolated small plaque, it's a centimeter big, in a sun-exposed area, it's not getting better with your treatment. Really, a dermatologist should be involved in that case. Understanding the impact on health-related quality of life, very important. A patient's subjective experience often doesn't correlate with what we predict it may be. And so asking those questions about impact on mood and well-being, impact on physical symptoms is very important as well.
So even in this age where we're all so pressured to see as many patients as we can in short periods of time, I frequently tell my colleagues that it's very important when evaluating a patient with seronegative arthritis to disrobe them completely at every visit. Whether you've made the diagnosis of psoriatic arthritis or not, if you have, to monitor for developing lesions, and if you haven't, to be certain that you're not going to pick up something that wasn't there previously.
Yeah, and I think a case can be made. It's just how the rheumatologist is the sort of gold standard of diagnosing psoriatic arthritis. It's a clinical diagnosis, there's no test for it. It's a diagnosis of exclusion to some extent. Same thing with psoriasis. There's no diagnostic test that we use. It's a clinical diagnosis. And so I think that for a patient who's going to have a long long-term chronic disease, it's worthwhile having at least one visit to a dermatologist to make sure we have the right diagnosis of the skin, because other common problems like eczema or tinea infections or allergic contact dermatitis or isolated skin cancers can mimic psoriasis. And the last thing you want to do is be going down a certain treatment pathway thinking you're dealing with cutaneous psoriasis and realizing that it was something else all along.
So, Jennifer, Joel and I practice in academic towers. You're out in the trenches in the community. How frequently are you referring patients that you're evaluating with rheumatic disease conditions, whether it's psoriatic arthritis or not, to dermatologists for evaluation?
Actually, more than you would expect. We actually have a very good relationship with our local dermatologists. A lot of them will send us patients who have arthritic symptoms to rule out psoriatic arthritis or just really to monitor them. So we've been interestingly surprised at how many people come to us with psoriasis. Maybe they don't have active arthritis at the time, but then over time, let's say 6 months, a year later, all of a sudden they'll have classic symptoms of psoriatic arthritis, and we can really change therapy then. In addition, just as Joel said, there are cases where we have resistant psoriasis. We've got them on maximum medication, they're compliant with their medications, and there's something that doesn't look right. There's either disease that won't go away, or there's suspicious lesions that won't go away.
Yeah, ultimately the goal is helping the patient cross the finish line, having their skin clear and their joint symptoms resolved. And oftentimes, if their joints are doing really well, the dermatologist can come in with some adjunctive therapy, maybe some of our more sophisticated topical medications we have available now, or ultraviolet light therapies, what have you. We can get the patient cleared and have a real full success story.
Yes.
So let's move on to the second learning objective, which is to develop individualized treatment plans for patients with psoriatic arthritis that weigh the risks and benefits of the newer agents. And we have some recommendations or guidelines from a couple of respected professional organizations. We should first compare and contrast the EULAR and GRAPPA recommendations. EULAR, of course, is the European League Against Rheumatism, GRAPPA, the Group on Research for Psoriatic Arthritis. And both of them have recommendations for the use of small molecules, TNF inhibitors, other biologics, and apremilast, another small molecule. They differ in terms of where these molecules are placed. They differ in terms of when the molecules should be used and what agents should be used in what order. But there does appear to be some consensus on the fact that the treatment of patients with psoriatic arthritis should be a process of continued evaluation and making appropriate choices based on what is present at what time and to what degree the therapy that you're using is actually either clearing the skin, or for us as rheumatologists, we're focusing on to what extent the joints are being improved. So these are the EULAR and GRAPPA recommendations. We will very soon have the American College of Rheumatology National Psoriasis Foundation guidelines. These were presented in draft form last year at the ACR and should be available to us in final form soon. And you can appreciate that these categorize our patients into those that are treatment naive, those that are active despite a small molecule, those that are active with axial disease despite non-steroidals, and those that are active with axial disease despite non-steroidals and a biologic. And we have various choices that we can make. The key point here is that the majority of these recommendations are based on different levels of evidence. Therefore, they're conditional, and all of them need to be discussed with the patient in the context of the physician-patient partnership that so very much enhances and leads to optimal therapy. Also, all of these guidelines incorporate, by reference, if you will, the treat-to-target recommendations of coupling a therapeutic choice or modification with disease activity metrics on each patient at each visit. So let's drill down a bit and go into some more detail on the efficacy of these agents in both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. Joel, I'll begin the discussion with summarizing the efficacy of these agents in psoriasis.
Yeah. So before we get into that, I want to touch back on the ACR guidelines that are likely to emerge soon. I think what's really paradigm shifting here is a focus on a biologic strategy. So, you know, for years, methotrexate was the place to start with inflammatory arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, I should say. And now that's really being changed to TNF inhibitors being the first line recommendation for these patients who have, who are treatment naive psoriatic arthritis patients. A big change. For our audience to be aware of when these guidelines have finally come out. And TNF inhibitors have been around for about 15 years for psoriatic arthritis and psoriatic disease, And the IL-17s are sort of newer to the market. Those have been around for 2 or 3 years. Now, we're interested to see, as we accumulate more data, what the proper sequence is of biologics in these patients. But talking about efficacy and coming to the next slide again, on your y-axis here is what we call PASI 90. And what that basically means is the odds of the patient having 90% or greater response in the skin, which it clinically basically means they're clear or almost clear their skin disease, a very high bar if you think about what we do in rheumatology, which is usually a 20% improvement in the ACR, for example. And starting with the oral medications on the left, in general, these tend to have lower absolute response rates, lower odds of having completely clear skin, but often are preferred by patients because they may not require monitoring in the case of apremilast, for example, and many patients prefer pills over injectable medications. Tofacitinib, of course, is not approved for psoriasis, but large phase 3 programs have been completed for this drug, and we know it has efficacy for the skin disease, so when rheumatologists are using it for the joint disease, they can appreciate that the skin should improve as well. Again, with the response rates probably lower than what we might expect from some of our newer biologics. I think what's interesting in the dermatology space is that the TNF inhibitors actually do distinguish themselves on efficacy in the skin, whereas in the joints they tend to have fairly comparable efficacy. In psoriasis, we know drugs like etanercept, for example, don't perform as well as, say, adalimumab, sotolizumab, or infliximab. And then this comes on to our newer agents, ustekinumab, IL-12/23 inhibitor, an excellent drug. But we continue to make advances. So the IL-17s have response rates that are achieving 70 to 80% of patients getting clear, almost clear. That's remarkable. And the new IL-23s, even more targeted than ustekinumab, having similarly high response rates, roughly 85% of patients getting close to clear, almost clear, their skin disease.
So the obvious caveat here, and also in the next slide, which is the commonly used therapies for psoriatic arthritis, is that we're showing you the data on a number of agents concurrently, but these were not head-to-head studies. So one has to interpret them individually rather than collectively in terms of making up your mind in an individual patient.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I should add to that that for illustrative purposes, it's sort of helpful to get a sense of where these drugs track. These are all from phase 3 clinical trial data, so you get a decent sense of what's happening. But in our field, there's been a lot more head-to-head studies. So now there's been many head-to-head studies of the new IL-23s against, say, ustekinumab or adalimumab, or the IL-17s against these drugs. And generally speaking, they always beat the TNF or the IL-12/23. So we do have the head-to-head data now emerging, at least in skin disease.
And we're seeing a few in rheumatology as well, mm-hmm. but not as many as we'd like. And we always give the caveat, don't make comparisons in the absence of head-to-head, and yet we frequently do mm-hmm. when we put slides like this together. Mm-hmm. But the obvious caveat is out there. So for psoriatic arthritis, you see here the ACR20 response rates and the numbers of patients needed to treat. Our largest experience, of course, is with the anti-TNF inhibitors, and then we're gaining additional experience with the anti-IL-17s, the anti-12/23s, the small molecules apremilast and tofa, and another biologic, abatacept, which is a T-cell modulator, and you have some sense of their relative efficacy, but again, the caveat, these are not head-to-head studies, but they're there for illustration and should be an individual factor decision for any individual patient, coupled with concerns about comorbidities, as we've already discussed and we'll discuss a bit later. But Joel, while we've talked about these agents, the dosing of these agents may differ in terms of their use in psoriasis, mm-hmm. as well as their use in psoriatic arthritis. So take us through that and concerns we should be having about what to use and when to use it.
Yeah, so as a general rule, it seems like you need higher doses of biologics to manage skin disease, psoriasis, compared to the inflammatory joint disease, psoriatic arthritis. And so it's important for the rheumatologist, when they're the ones prescribing the biologics, to recognize, are we choosing joint disease dosing or skin disease dosing? Because by underdosing the patients, we may benefit their joints, but still have a lot of residual skin disease. And so examples of this are plenty. Adalimumab, for example, has a loading dose in psoriasis, which you don't necessarily have to do in psoriatic arthritis. So your patient with substantial skin disease, comorbid with a joint disease, you may want to think about using psoriasis dosing. And this is true for a number of the other therapies we use. I should note golimumab is not FDA approved for psoriasis. We don't have big trials examining its efficacy in that disease state, at least in moderate to severe disease. Looking at the other agents we have available to ourselves, the IL-12-23s, like ustekinumab, the IL-17, secukinumab, and ixekizumab, all of these are approved both for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. And again, with slightly different schedules in terms of loading doses or absolute dose. A good example might be secukinumab, for example. In that situation, for someone who has psoriatic arthritis but very mild skin disease, which is often going to be the case because mild skin disease is very prevalent in the general population relative to more severe skin disease. So for most rheumatologists, most patients will have fairly mild skin disease with their arthritis. And in that case, you would start them at about 150 milligram type dosing if they had very mild skin disease. But if they have more severe skin disease, you're looking at 300 milligram dosing for secukinumab. And I think I'll for the drugs for psoriatic arthritis, maybe I'll refer back to you, Alan, to let us know what you think about the dosing schedules for these.
Well, I think for the oral agents in particular, the dosing agents are quite easy to administer. We have tofacitinib in psoriatic arthritis, not in psoriasis, which we can give as a twice a day or a once a day dose. And we taper, of course, according to whether or not they have severe renal impairment or some degree of hepatic impairment. Apremilast is a very easy drug to give. Apremilast is given twice a day, but we build up to its use with a titration schedule in order to minimize the GI complaints that have been seen early on, which do tend to disappear. The interesting thing about apremilast is that we don't have to do any laboratory testing concomitant with it, and the incidence of adverse events has really been minimal. Some uncomfortable things, but nothing that has really required significant discontinuation of the drug. There is a titration for patients with severe renal impairment, but otherwise the drug is quite easy to give. So we've talked a little bit about how the drugs work, what doses are supposed to work, but the question always comes up, and we'll spend a little bit more time on this later, about how long they work and to what extent these drugs are durable over time. And we have some data that really just came out of the European meeting about a month ago in terms of how these agents do in the long term. We can begin by looking at ustekinumab, the results from a non-interventional SUSTAIN study, showing you that over a 76-week period, the results achieved are durable in terms of both the tender and swollen joint reduction that is achieved. And we have the physician and patient responses in terms of telling us how well these endpoints are being met as well. We also have data from the Future 2 trial of secukinumab, where not only were the ACR 20s, 50s, and PASI 75s looked at, but also there is data on improvement in patient-reported outcomes on the health assessment questionnaire, improvement in enthesitis and dactylitis at 3 years time. And this has been shown to be true regardless of prior therapies that the patients may have received. We can also look at data for ixekizumab for the treatment of psoriatic arthritis, the 3-year SPIRIT-P1 results, again showing you the durability of the ACR 20 and 50 as well as the PASI 75. Also, with demonstrated improvements in enthesitis and dactylitis over that period of time as well. And finally, we can look at the data from the two oral targeted agents. This is also data from EULAR presented by our good friend Artie Kavanaugh, no relation. And you can see here the pooled analysis of the PALLAS studies for 5-year data for apremilast with the ACR 20s, 50s, and PASI 75s. And finally, we have the data on tofacitinib, the 15-month data from Opal Balance. The drug has not been around as long as apremilast has for psoriatic arthritis. But even at this time point, you can see durability of the ACR20, the ACR50, and the PASI 75. The obvious caveat here is when you look at long-term data, is that patients who do well do well, and patients who do well stay on the drug. Patients who don't do well go off the drug, and so we have to at least factor into our thinking what percentage of patients, of those that started, are we actually looking at the point in time that we're seeing the long-term extension data. Now, the flip side of efficacy is safety. You never want a patient to be worse off treated than untreated. So we do have to think about the safety of these agents to temper our enthusiasm a bit about their efficacy. This slide shows you the common side effects and black box warnings for the class of agents that we've been referring to as the five TNF inhibitors. Joel, walk us through this slide.
Yeah, so I think that when it comes to biologics, you know, the common side effects tend to be pretty mild, things that usually don't result in the patient stopping therapy. Mainly what we're more concerned about is rare, serious potential side effects. And it's often difficult to distinguish for certain if they're really drug-caused or just coincident with drug exposure due to other risk factors, but it's the complexity of working all these things out. What you know with the TNF inhibitors, they have unique issues related to potentially inducing or exacerbating demyelinating disease. So that's a differentiating factor. A patient with a history of optic neuritis, for example, you're probably going to want to move towards a different class of drugs than, say, TNF inhibitors. TNF inhibitors could also potentially aggravate underlying congestive heart failure. Patients with more advanced heart failure, stage 3 or stage 4, you're probably going to want to move away from TNF inhibitors and look at other mechanisms of action. And, of course, they carry black box warnings for serious infections and malignancies. Now, coming to some of our newer mechanisms of actions, at least the IL-12/23, ustekinumab, and the IL-17s, again, the common reactions are quite benign when it comes down to it. They usually don't stop it for these reasons. There's no black box warnings for these agents. What's a little unique about secukinumab and ixekizumab is that in some cases they've been found to aggravate underlying inflammatory bowel disease. So your patient who has Crohn's disease or a strong family history of Crohn's disease, you might want to think about trying other mechanisms of actions than, say, the IL-17s. Ustekinumab and its label has a warning for malignancy based on its mechanism of action. But based on the data to date, there's really no definitive evidence the drug causes cancer. But interestingly, our newer therapies, secukinumab, ixekizumab, because of their mechanism of action and their data to date, the FDA has no warning information about malignancy risk associated with those therapies based on our current state of knowledge. Our other therapies, abatacep, another biologic, similar story in terms of most side effects that are common, are pretty mild, unlikely to stop therapy. Tofacitinib is a drug that requires some more laboratory monitoring. It can cause problems with the blood count. It can cause issues with the liver function tests and lipids, so those are recommended to be monitored. What's unique to tofacitinib, in addition to its black box warning of serious infections and malignancies, is induction of herpes zoster, shingles. And this seems very unique to this mechanism of action of blocking the JAK kinase in this situation. And we're lucky now we have new vaccines, a killed vaccine that's dosed at baseline and about 2 to 6 months later, the second dose should be given. And it's a killed vaccine, so it could be given to a patient who's on immune modulating therapy if necessary. It's recommended by the CDC for everyone 50 or older. I think if I was using a tofacitinib, I might use it in people who are younger as well. And then apremilast, you know, its most common side effects relate to GI symptoms, nausea, headache, things of that nature. And some patients do need to stop the drug because of this reason. So we need to warn them about it so they're prepared for what the symptoms may be like. Rarely people develop depression on apremilast. About 1% of patients reported to have depression on this drug in clinical trials. That's a warning as part of prescribing information so the patients should be aware of it. But the nice thing about apremilast, very short half-life drugs. So the patient's having problems with their GI tract, for example, they just stop it and those symptoms usually revert very quickly. And of course, no laboratory monitoring is very convenient for the patients and the providers.
So Joel, it strikes me that the biologics were first used in predominantly in rheumatoid arthritis, and then you dermatologists took them and began using them in psoriasis. Mm. And now we have a number of drugs that are being used in psoriasis that we rheumatologists plan to take back for psoriatic arthritis. Tell us a little bit about drugs that are being used in psoriasis that may find their way into my discipline someday.
Right, yeah. So I think this is actually really exciting because what we didn't really know is which cytokines are really driving skin disease or joint disease. We now fundamentally think at least the skin disease is an IL-23, IL-17 pathway problem. And that's because of the very high efficacy you see with agents targeting those pathways. And so guselkumab, which we showed earlier, has very high efficacy in the skin, one of our higher efficacy drugs. The question was, well, would it work for joint disease? Because we just don't know that mechanism of action would be effective. We know we have ustekinumab, an IL-12-23 inhibitor, and we just don't know, is it the IL-12 or 23 activity of that drug that gives us benefit. And what's striking in this sort of small phase 2 trial is that guselkumab, an IL-23 inhibitor, has ACR20 responses that seem to be in line with what a TNF inhibitor may provide. Similarly with other IL-23 inhibitors, such as risankizumab, we'll look at our next slide, has similar data showing nice ACR responses. So this awaits confirmation in phase 3. Ultimately, head-to-head trials against TNF or IL-17 will be necessary. But hopefully these drugs will add another option for our patients.
So we've covered a lot of ground already. We've talked about genes, targets, individualizing care, and the members of the healthcare team. Our last learning objective is to evaluate recent clinical trial data regarding the impact of long-term treatment on improving pain and quality of life. These are the domains that probably mean the most to our patients. Jennifer, can you summarize the effect of the treatments on pain endpoints, such as the visual analog scale?
Right, so this is the visual analog scale, and you'll see basically across the board that all of the agents that we were talking about really do decrease pain on a visual analog scale. Methotrexate perhaps less so than the others, but again, these are not direct comparisons. These are individual agents, but they all do work. They all work for pain.
Yeah, and we've also seen data for the long-term effects of secukinumab on pain. And you see here some lovely data from Ian McGuinness and his colleagues looking at both the clinical trial as well as extension periods, showing you the effect on pain at both doses and the durability of the effect on pain over time. So we have the long-term effects there. We have the long-term effects of ixekizumab on the health assessment questionnaire disability index. We have the improvements from baseline of the HAC-DI up to 156 weeks in the SPIRIT-P1 results. So not only are we seeing relief of signs and symptoms, which are most important to us, of course, to our patients, but we're also seeing improvement in patient-reported outcomes, which means even more to them. But with all the drugs that we're using, Joel, we also need to think about drug survival. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think this is a really important concept that our audience become aware of, which is ultimately our goal when treating people with a chronic long-term disease that's incurable is to make sure we can choose a therapy that's going to be effective for them and then maintain their remission for a long period of time. And the biologics have had so many different advances for us in the care of our patients. Their one Achilles heel tends to be persistence. The most common reason people stop these therapies is usually loss of efficacy developing over time. Now, there's a fairly big literature out there on rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis looking at drug persistence with biologics. And this literature is now emerging in the psoriatic arthritis arena as well. So this is recent data that has been published and presented at UR in 2018, looking at survival rates of predominantly TNF inhibitors in this study based on the sample size. And on your y-axis is essentially the percent of patients remaining on drug, and then on your x-axis is time in weeks. And so you can see that by about 50 weeks, by about a year, most patients are coming off their drug and having to move on to another therapy. And so one of the take-home messages for people listening to this is that you can't just choose one mechanism of action to use or just one MOA within, one drug within an MOA, but invariably many of your patients are going to have to switch within class or between classes to maintain long-term remission of their disease. One thing we've learned in the psoriasis literature is that the IL-12-23 mechanism seems to have the best persistence. We're still trying to understand if IL-17s will have that type of long-term persistence the way we see with IL-12-23s, and we'll have to see how this pans out for psoriatic arthritis as more data emerges.
Yeah, the slide also tells us that when we have more choices, we often tend to switch drugs more often in an attempt to find the right one for the right patient. Mm-hmm. So it also tells us that perhaps we should be willing to give a drug a chance before moving on to the next one. Mm-hmm. And what that period would be probably varies from individual to individual based on what you're seeing occurring at any point in time. Jen, would you agree?
I would.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a dermatologist, usually we say at least 12 weeks you want to wait to see a response in the skin. If they're really not responding at all by 12 weeks, you have a pretty good sense they're not likely to get that much better than that. So we don't want to quit too early. You know, 4 weeks in, 8 weeks in, we should give the drug some time. But if we're getting to 12 weeks, 16 weeks, we probably have a good sense we need to move on.
And that 12-week period seems to be the appropriate sweet spot for rheumatoid arthritis and probably for psoriatic arthritis as well. I've mentioned a concept called treat to target. Has it been implemented in psoriatic arthritis to the degree that it has been in rheumatoid arthritis? And if so, what do we see?
Yeah, so I think this is a paradigm in evaluation and in evolution currently. I think what's really elegant about the rheumatoid arthritis data is you have really nice trials and observational studies showing that if you use a treat-to-target approach, that you could then prevent sequelae of disease like joint damage, for example. We don't have that level of data yet in psoriatic arthritis, but logically extending it from psoriatic from rheumatoid arthritis, you think that would be the case. And so in this very nice study by Laura Coates, published in Lancet a couple years back, this is sort of an older approach. The treat to target was mainly a methotrexate-based strategy, a small molecule, as opposed to featuring the biologics. But basically what they're able to show with, you know, relatively lower efficacy approaches, methotrexate in this case, that those on treat to target compared to standard of care are much more likely to achieve better control of their joint outcomes as well as their skin outcomes. There was a small trade-off. There was more serious side effects in those getting the treat-to-target approach, still a low frequency of serious side effects that occurred. And if we repeat the study with more modern agents that are better tolerated, it's likely we may find something different.
So we've been using the term digital health. We've heard that term a lot. It's becoming increasingly useful in the management of many diseases, and that probably includes psoriatic arthritis. Jennifer, tell us a little bit about the use of digital health tools for our patients with psoriatic arthritis.
Absolutely. The digital health tool is actually going to be helpful for both the clinician as well as the patient. Citizen Scientist is created by the National Psoriasis Foundation, and it promotes patient-centered psoriatic disease research. Also, the National Psoriasis Foundation has both psoriasis as well as psoriatic arthritis guidelines and pocket guides to help guide our treatment options. And then what I find most exciting as a clinician is the Patient Navigation Center, and this is really great for our patients. So it gives them options in terms of assistance with medication denials, finding the appropriate doctors in the areas that they're in, looking for different patient assistance programs to help them afford their medication, which is extremely important. In addition, there are, on the next slide, multiple different other tools that we would use in terms of tracking medications, staying active, managing psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, and that's really important. So as you alluded to before, in this day and age where we're trying to see as many patients as we need to help with our patients, we don't always have the time that we would like with each of our patients. So a lot of these applications will help track their disease, track their symptoms, so the patients can bring that to our office. In addition, there are other apps and different digital health tools that will help with managing the psychosocial aspect of the disease, including managing their anxiety and depression.
So in the words of the millennials, when it comes to psoriatic arthritis, there's an app for that, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So we've covered quite a lot, and I think our useful discussion hopefully has been deemed useful to our listeners and watchers as well. But I want to bring it to a close now with some specific things for them. So, Joel, what are the two key things that our clinicians should be doing differently in their practice based on today's program?
Yeah, well, Alan, I know we're coming to the top of the hour, so I'll be brief here. I think one is monitoring patient-reported outcomes is important, both understanding the physical and mental well-being of your patients, the impact their disease is having on those domains. You could do that using simple global assessments or scales of 0 to 10. And tracking the biosurface area and what we call physician's global assessment, the redness, thickness, and scaliness of overall lesions in the patients, and we'll have that tool that we can show to our audience in the slide deck. These are things you can use to track disease activity over time and also document the EHR for the purposes of getting approval of drugs. Increasingly, insurance companies want to know, you know, how bad is their skin disease? Is it bad enough to justify the use of a more expensive agent?
Jennifer, anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yes, I'll be brief as well. I would stay tuned for the new ACR guidelines as there may be a shift in treatment paradigms. I think that that will be very exciting. And then as if you have time to really go through the last slide, looking for integrative digital health tools to incorporate that into clinical practice as well.
Well, thank you both, Joel, Jennifer. I want to remind our audience that we've created a very useful downloadable resource that includes the slides we presented, as well as additional slides for your review and reference. I encourage you to please visit www.cmeoutfitters.com for a comprehensive list of clinical resources, outcomes research news, additional educational activities for both providers and your patients, and a whole lot more. I look forward to answering your questions. We look forward to discussing your clinical challenges. And thank you again for joining us for the presentation portion of our program. And I encourage you to stay with us for the after the show segment, which will come right up, where we will answer your questions and address any clinical challenges that you may have incurred. I hope that you'll be able to integrate some of the precision medicine strategies and digital health tools we've discussed today into your care of patients with psoriatic arthritis. And we'll be back in 1 minute. So welcome back. We've already received some questions, so let's jump right in. So, Joel, there's a question that actually you and I discussed in the break room before the program. The watcher comments, great program. How do you discuss all these treatments with your patients when we're pressed for time? How do you cover your gluteus maximus while documenting?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think the press for time part is certainly the challenging aspect of this, because as we have increasing options to avail ourselves of, we have increasing responsibilities in making sure that patients are properly informed about what their different treatment options are going to be. What I try and do is try and break it down into different categories. So we're talking about pills versus injectables, and then going within categories about mechanism of actions, and then trying to land on what I think may be a good option for the patient, ultimately helping the patient choose what they think is best for them. I use a lot of digital health tools, so we're on an EMR at our health system, so we have smart phrases explaining the risks and benefits of the various therapies available, and so as soon as the patient is deciding which one they want to prefer, they then get additional information that helps them think more about what they want to do. And oftentimes, it's an ongoing discussion, at least in the skin area, where, fortunate for us, the skin does not cause permanent damage in the skin, permanent scarring. And psoriatic arthritis, maybe there's a little less time sometimes to make a choice. So oftentimes we'll see a patient, we'll get the blood test work up to make sure they don't have pre-existing conditions like tuberculosis, for example, that may change our thinking on therapies. And then they have some time to think about what option they want, and then we go from there.
Jennifer, how do you handle the issue of documentation and informed consent when you're educating your patients?
So that is true. I mean, we have an EMR that basically does a lot of smart phrases, but occasionally what we have to do is bring the patients back, sit down, really discuss this. I will refer them to digital health tools to have them really go through the different side effects. But it is difficult to get that done in the amount of time we're really allotted. We do have an EMR where the patients are able to go home and then email us. That actually sometimes is useful as well.
So, Joel, can a patient manifest psoriatic arthritis without first showing psoriasis?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's a fairly significant portion of patients, probably about 10%, maybe 15%, up to 20% in some studies, where you will see the joint disease occur, and then eventually the skin disease may come up or may never come up. Again, I think one of the practical tips is to make sure you look in the ears, look in the scalp or behind the ears, other hidden areas for psoriasis, nail disease. These are all little pearls that you could be looking for to help you distinguish between psoriatic arthritis and other forms of inflammatory arthritis.
Yeah, I think, as I indicated earlier, it's worthwhile to disrobe patients completely when you're evaluating a patient for a seronegative condition to see whether any skin lesions have evolved in the course of their treatment, or even when you've made the diagnosis, whether any other skin manifestations will evolve. But, Jennifer, can we just add methotrexate and see if it will maintain the durability of a biologic that we're using?
So that was another question that came up. I am actually not sure about the psoriatic literature. There's actually data in the rheumatoid arthritis literature, but I'm not familiar with any data in terms of the psoriatic arthritis arena.
So, Joel, a questioner asked to elaborate a bit more on the cardiovascular risk in these patients specifically, and should dermatologists or rheumatologists be measuring blood pressure and hemoglobin A1C in patients, or should we leave that to the PCP?
Yeah, so this is a good question, and I think guidelines are evolving on this topic. The American Academy of Dermatology psoriasis guidelines are being updated as we speak, and so we'll see what the final deliberations come out of those guidelines soon. ULAR has a series of guidelines, really, again, encouraging physicians to be educating patients about these associated risks, screening for risk factors, or referring them back to their primary care doctor. What we know about people with psoriatic disease is that they tend to be loaded with cardiovascular risk factors. These are often undiagnosed or undertreated, and so it's an important place to start for improving our patients' overall health and well-being.
So there's a question about the use of patient-reported outcomes. We have different ones in each of our disciplines, but do you use them? How much effort do they require? Mm-hmm. And can they be administered by office staff rather than us primarily? Jennifer, let me start with you.
We're talking about patient-related outcome
patient
measures.
Patient-reported outcomes.
Yes. So in our practice, when we do, we have the medical assistants, or actually the nurse practitioners, will oftentimes administer the test, and then we document it inside our EMR.
Yeah, and so what we do in our practice is we use two simple global questions. We ask the patient first on the physical symptoms of their skin disease, their psoriasis, burning, itching, flaking, things of that nature. How bad is it? 10 being the worst, 0 being no symptoms at all, and a somewhat more threatening question is the emotional burden of disease. We ask that second. And you often have to be prepared to take time with the patient at that point, because for many patients, they've never been asked that question before. You know, how much of an emotional toll is this disease taking? And we'll ask about how you're anxious about the disease, depressed about it, or how it's affecting your relationships, on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the worst, 0 being not at all. So those are simple global measures people could use in their practice and track over time. There is an instrument called the Dermatology Life Quality Index. It's a 10-question instrument. Not really used in the United States, but it's actually commonly used in Europe, and often is used in our clinical trials. So for those who want to really go the extra mile, I guess, that would be another option.
So it occurs to me that in our Venn diagram slide, we may have listed an incomplete list of colleagues, and one of our colleagues asks, what is the role for pharmacists in the education of patients who are on these agents we've been discussing? Jennifer?
So there is. I mean, a lot of our specialized medications actually are from specialty pharmacies, right? So it's not like they go to their local pharmacist and ask questions. But actually, I've been impressed with the fact that oftentimes the specialty pharmacists will actually screen them as well in terms of what should have been screened in terms of tuberculosis or hepatitis or occasionally other medical conditions as well.
I think our pharmacist is incredibly helpful for us. Again, I practice in a large health system, so we have a pharmacist embedded in our practice, works with us and a rheumatologist. And this is extremely helpful on a number of levels. One is, as people increasingly understand that we don't really have prescription pads anymore, we have suggestion pads. And so you may want to choose mechanism of action A, and then the insurance will come back and say you need to use B. And then that invokes a whole series of more discussions with the patients to make sure they understand the risks and benefits of that therapy. But it's them being connected with the pharmacist is very helpful early on in terms of navigating the insurance approval process. And then also, invariably, questions come up. I did my injection and it misfired. What do I do? And our pharmacists are very helpful in getting extra doses in those kind of cases. So having a good connection to a pharmacist is really important for our patients.
So I think we've touched on this question, but it might be helpful to flesh it out a bit. When can psoriatic arthritis patients expect to see a response with the various agents? So let's start with the skin and then go to the joints. Joel?
So in the skin, some of our newer mechanisms of actions, the IL-17s, you could start seeing people having significant responses within 2 weeks. It's pretty remarkable. That's in the skin response for IL-17s, with some patients achieving primary endpoints at as early as 2 to 4 weeks. It's pretty remarkable. But most typically looking at the most efficacy coming in around 12 weeks, sometimes peaking at 24 weeks for patients. So usually you get at least a 12-week trial of these medications before you decide that it may not be effective enough for the patient you're treating.
Jen?
And I would have to agree with Joel. So if you believe the literature, you might start seeing improvements as early as 2 weeks. But I think there is a difference between clinical trials and clinical practice, right? So oftentimes what the clinical trials will say 2 weeks, and the patients think, well, I should feel better at 2 weeks, we really tell them to sometimes hold on. Because really through up to 12 weeks to 24 weeks, you'll continue to see improvement.
So here's an interesting question. The specifics are for one agent, but I'm going to broaden it a bit. If a patient has an inadequate response to one member of a class of biologics after an appropriate period of time, should we go to another member in that class, or should we move out of class to another member, to another agent entirely? Joel?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on what we're talking about when we mean an inadequate response. So you have what's called primary failure. I tried a TNF inhibitor and they had no evidence of response, or what we call secondary failure. They went on a TNF inhibitor, they did great for a couple of years, and they lost response. This is addressed mainly by observational data, which seems to indicate if they had a primary response failure, they are less likely to do well if you use another TNF inhibitor. And so in those people, you probably should think about changing classes. For those who had secondary failure, they lost response over time, they do have a good chance of having a good response to the next TNF inhibitor that you may want to choose. So I think understanding what we mean by loss of response, what the patient means, will help dictate where you want to go.
So we have great data about that in rheumatoid arthritis, but say in psoriatic arthritis, where we have classes of other agents like the IL-17 inhibitors, mm-hmm. if the patient has had a secondary inadequate response to one IL-17, would you give them another IL-17, or would you go to something else?
Yeah, no, I think that if they lost response over time but did well initially, then certainly changing to another IL-17 is a very good strategy. Oftentimes what happens, too, is that some patients, you know, dosing is very variable in terms of what dose patients need. So they maybe do well in the initial induction period when we're treating skin disease. Say for ixekizumab, for example, they're getting dosed every 2 weeks for the first 12 weeks, then monthly. And so sometimes what you'll see is that the patients do great for that first 3 to 6 months. Then after you've gotten pretty far out of the induction period, they start seeming like they're losing response. And really what's happened is they don't have enough drug levels to maintain their response. And so in those cases, potentially increasing frequency or reloading is necessary to recalibrate and re-achieve responses for the patient.
Jen, anything you want to add to Joel?
No, I was going to make... I think of the comment that you were making, which is if you look at the slide that was talking about secukinumab, if you're not getting the response at the psoriatic arthritis dose, so you might want to switch to the psoriasis dose, mm-hmm. Which would be a higher dose, and that may recapture.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines, Jennifer, how do you discuss long-term outcomes with patients? And more specifically, how do you keep them engaged but make their expectations realistic?
So that's an interesting question. So I think one of the big challenges in clinical practice is adherence, right? So if your skin gets better and your joints get better, well, I don't want to necessarily inject myself every 2 weeks. But what I think we have to mention to them is, you know, these are diseases that have other manifestations. There are diseases that have other cardiovascular risks. These are diseases that, if untreated, can continue on to joint damage. And so I think it's really important to engage your patient and remind them of all of these things over time, that it really is important for them to stay compliant with their medications.
So, Joel, is there a role for immune-enhancing agents in the management of psoriatic arthritis? I'm not quite sure how broadly or narrowly you want to define that,
yeah.
But take a shot at it.
Yeah, so the other terms we'd use is things like immunosuppression. And I think now what we realize is that we're really immunomodulating our patients, meaning that these patients have elevations in cytokines that are pathologic, and we're trying to essentially normalize them. And that's what really the target or paradigm is in 2018.
So I'm going to take a shot at this one. Do you see genetics having a bigger role in treatment in the future? What about matching treatment and real precision medicine? Mm-hmm. Boy, I think that is the $64,000 question, as we used to say. I think that we're going to see an evolution of our field and your field, almost like the oncologist or the infectious disease specialist, where you take a sample of something. You send it for maybe a cytokine analysis or a cell profile, fax analysis, and then you tailor the therapy to the patient based on what profile returns. And I think that's going to be a combination of the host genetics as well as what is operative in that patient at that time. I've often thought of our diseases like the old circus game whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know which mole's head is up, so you end up whacking them down in almost a stereotypical prescribed fashion. But it does you no good to smack down the IL-17 mole if it's the TNF mole mm-hmm. that's up. And it does you no good to smack down the IL-12 mole if it's the IL-17 and the TNF mole that are halfway up. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are going to see the utilization of genetics and cytokine profiling and cellular composition analyses to really get down to creating cocktails for our patients and not just individual drugs. Joel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think in the psoriasis space, there's some research in this area emerging, both of methotrexate and TNF inhibitors and also IL-12-23 inhibitors, looking at genetic susceptibility loci, like if they're HLA-CD6 positive, that has some prognostic value or response. But it's not so strong that it's clinically useful at this point in time. You know, doing these tests may change the margin a little bit of their likelihood of responding, but not so much so that it's really worth doing. I think the other part of literature to keep an eye on is biomarkers in the blood or PK levels of the drug to figure out what the proper dosing schedule should be. The PK varies quite a bit from patient to patient in terms of half-life of a drug, say a TNF inhibitor like adalimumab. And so some patients, as we know, need to be dosed weekly when it's really approved for every two-week drug. Other patients can get along with monthly dosing. And so it's likely over time we'll have better serologic markers decide what the dosing frequency of the drug should be.
Jen, comments?
No, I think that pretty much covers that.
Okay. We've used the term treat to target. Now, that's coin of the realm for us rheumatologists in rheumatoid arthritis, but how do you define it and how do you use it as a dermatologist mm-hmm. in psoriatic arthritis, Joel?
Yeah, so when it comes to psoriatic arthritis, it's not a disease state that we view as our primary management responsibilities. So if the patient has comorbid PSA and they're symptom-free on the drug we're giving them, then we'll feel satisfied. But if they have any residual symptoms, usually we're going to work with the rheumatologist at that point in time to fine-tune their therapy and see what we need to do. This concept is coming to dermatology as well. The National Psoriasis Foundation put out a consensus statement on this topic, of which I was one of the authors. Really, when you talk to patients and a lot of the stakeholders, what patients want is they want their skin to be completely clear. That's what they're hoping for. And so increasingly our targets are sort of geared toward trying to achieve high levels of clearance in the skin, recognizing that we can't get there in every patient. But if you don't have a target or you don't have a way of measuring things, you have no way of improving over time. And so by understanding how well we're doing this year, we can then figure out, well, how can I do even better next year?
I think it was Lord Kelvin who said, if you can't measure it, you don't know it.
That's right.
So we have to be coupling our disease activity metrics with our therapeutic changes and not just making our therapeutic changes based on our gestalt. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, our colleague asks for a little bit more discussion on what is a citizen scientist. Could you tell them a bit more about it?
I'd be happy to, and then I think Joel can add in on this too. So the citizen scientist was from the National Psoriasis Foundation. Again, it was patients upload their information into a cloud-based web system, and it's to help direct psoriasis research.
Yeah, so this is actually a really fun platform, originally funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI. I'm a member of the Citizen Scientist Governing Board, so I'm active in this with the National Psoriasis Foundation. And it basically really allows patients to be more engaged with their disease. They could go online, they could fill out a bunch of surveys, and then they can ask questions of the data in real time and understand, well, how many patients are there out there like me who have, say, have psoriatic arthritis and failed these drugs, and what have they gone on to next? So it's a really powerful tool for engagement. In our case, it was very helpful for us prioritizing our own research that we're planning on doing, understanding what people who have more severe skin disease but not necessarily joint disease, what their preferences were for comparative studies. And so that led us down a path of doing a large pragmatic trial of phototherapy delivered in a home environment versus the office, which was recently funded by PCORI and will be starting in 2019.
So do I address you now as Citizen Gelfand, as in the old days of the French Revolution?
You may certainly do that.
Okay. A question here about the incidence of herpes zoster with the therapies that we're using. And should we be vaccinating all of our patients? Jennifer, let me start with you.
Yes, anybody over 50. So just as Joel had mentioned already, there's was approved at the end of last year a non-live vaccine for herpes zoster, FDA approved for anybody over 50. And I think that especially if they're on tofacitinib, absolutely should be vaccinated. So the first dose you would give, and then the next dose is 2 to 6 months afterwards. It's 0.5 cc's.
Yeah, so I think we haven't really talked much about this, but combination therapy often will get better efficacy, but does people more at risk for infections and things of that nature. So if they need to be on methotrexate and a little bit of steroid, those are people even more prone to having these adverse effects, and people we want to think about carefully about making sure they're up to date on age-appropriate vaccine schedules. So in our practice, we think about giving the pneumococcal vaccines, and we certainly think about giving the shingles vaccine as well. The TNF inhibitors have a fairly small signal, especially in monotherapy, but are associated with higher rates of herpes zoster. Tofacitinib certainly seems to have the most specific relationship to herpes zoster. The other novel therapies, the IL-17s, the IL-23s, theoretically we have to worry about it. Haven't seen it much yet in the initial data that's been emerging.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, the only thing else I was going to say is if anybody's interested, there are guidelines from the infectious disease societies about vaccination schedules for the immunocompromised patient, and it's worth looking at to go through, especially for your patients, to see what they would need to be on target for vaccinations.
So let me ask a follow-up question. We've talked about patients getting vaccinated. Do the vaccines get administered in your practice, or do you refer them to the PCP for it?
So I'm fortunate in my practice, we do have the ability to administer both pneumococcal and the herpes zoster vaccine. I think that if a patient, and Jen talked about compliance and adherence issues earlier, patients don't have to go into multiple doctor's offices, paying multiple co-pays. It's just a big burden for them. And let's face it, most of us aren't up to date on our vaccines either. We skip our flu shot and things of that nature.
No.
And
so,
yeah, not, present company excluded, I'm certain. But so that's, the easier we can make it for our patients to get these preventative measures, the more likely they are to benefit from them.
In the state of New York, you are not permitted to skip a flu shot if you're a healthcare provider, unless you want to spend the flu season walking around like looking like a bank robber with a mask over your face. Mm-hmm. So no, we do not skip those, but there are others. So Jennifer, a question, when will the new ACR guidelines be available? But more important, what will be the big difference that will impact clinicians in the community, and will it mean pay for performance measures?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I'm not sure about when the new ACR guidelines came out. I know that Dr. Ogdi Beatty had talked about them at the last ACR, and that was in 2017, but I'm assuming that they should be coming out probably in the next year. So sometime within 2018 is when my guess would be.
Yeah, that's a fair guess. I can tell you as a former ACR president that guidelines have to be vetted through a number of committees, the Committee on Research, the Committee on Guidelines, the Board of Directors itself. There has to be a period of public comment like anything else. But I think it's reasonable to think that we will see the next iteration, if not the near final, at the ACR meeting in Chicago this coming October. Joel, what do you think the next big approved therapy will be for psoriatic arthritis?
Well, I'll stick in the same venue, which is the IL-23s are coming along. And so risankizumab is the next kid in the block waiting to be FDA approved. It's been through phase 3. It's an IL-23 inhibitor. It'll probably be dosed every 3 months. And it has spectacular efficacy in the skin with being clear, being completely clear in about 50% of patients. So think about that, a complicated immunologic disease, multigenic disease, up to half of patients being completely clear on a drug like risankizumab. And then we showed some emerging data for joint disease there as well, and hopefully it'll be promising as it moves along that trajectory.
Thoughts, Jen?
No, but if I could go back to the last question,
my only
comment, because I think there was a second part of that question, was how are the treatment guidelines going to be different?
And I think, and how will they impact you as a clinician?
Yes, but I think that will make a difference. So as Joel said, if on the slide, it's probably about halfway through the deck, that instead of methotrexate as first-line agents, you could actually move on to a TNF, which even in treatment-naive patients. And I think that's really going to be a paradigm shift in terms of what we can get covered in terms of getting biologic agents faster for our patients, and then being able to tell the insurance companies, no, the new guidelines say we don't have to run through methotrexate first in order to get to biologic therapy, which I think will be really exciting.
I think it's a nice example of the power of 15 years of research and practice helping us come up with evidence-based suggestions that ultimately could be for the benefit of our patients.
Absolutely.
More patients getting disease control with fewer side effects, hopefully.
So we have a number of questions still in queue. Unfortunately, we can't get to them all. Those that we can't get to will be answered after the show. But a derivative from the last question, which is, how do you deal with access problems for our new medications? We have so many coming out, and some of them are doing different things than the others. Joel, how do you get access if you have a problem?
Yeah, so I think this is a really challenging problem for us, and it seems to change constantly. So as a clinician, I can never keep straight which drug is going to be approved by which insurance company on which day of the week. Having either a staff plan or a collaboration with a pharmacist who will manage that issue for you, I think is really critical. Many of the companies have generous patient support programs. In some instances, these could even be used in people on Medicare, for example, but not always. So the particular challenge is people with Medicare patients who are often not eligible for some of the company-supported aspects of drug access. And then the other thing we have to be aware of as clinicians is that we need to close the circle, close the loop on things. If you said you wanted to put a patient on, say, adalimumab for their psoriasis, and the plan came back and said you have to do this other biologic, you need to go back to the drawing board, make sure the patient understands what's involved and why we're choosing that therapy now, make sure that they're apprised of the benefits and risks of that approach.
Jen, access tips for us all?
No, I mean, that is the bane of our existence, I think. Patient care is a privilege, but I think that most of us who practice in the community will tell you that is our number one thorn, is patient access in terms of medications. But like Joel said, appeal processes, if you can document why you are choosing a particular drug and specifically, I think really helps. Mm-hmm. And then I think that the patient's assistance programs from the manufacturers are invaluable. Mm-hmm.
So thank you both. Hopefully our colleagues that stuck around found this as helpful as the primary show. I want to thank you again for joining me today, and I want to thank CME Outfitters for your assistance in developing this education activity. And finally, thank you to you, our audience. You took time out of your very busy day, at a very busy time of the day, to learn ways to improve the care of your patients with psoriatic arthritis. I'm Dr. Alan Gabowski, and I hope you're able to incorporate some of the recommendations we provided for you into the optimal care of your patients.